Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. In the next hour, we're talking about yesterday's hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Christine Blasey Ford testified about her allegations against Supreme Court nominee Judge Brett Kavanaugh. We'll take a look at how news organizations have been covering her reports of sexual misconduct with Kathleen Bartson Culver. She is the James E. Burgess Chair in Journalism Ethics at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. She spoke with me by phone yesterday about the role journalists played in revealing Kavanaugh's accuser. Dr. Christine Blasey Ford has talked about how she wanted to remain confidential with her allegations. I guess, what is the role of the media in bringing those allegations to light?
Well, I think she was very clear when she first contacted the Washington Post, if you believe all of the people who have been talking about it, that she did want to remain confidential. She wanted to get this, it seems to me that she wanted to get this information out there, but not have her name attached to it. The news media were restrained. The Washington Post was restrained in its reporting. It could not, you know, did not feel that it could go with the allegation while still keeping her confidential. It seemed to me that, you know, she was sort of feeling her way, you know, like trying to figure out exactly what to do with this information that seemed important to her.
Well, and, you know, since these allegations have come out, she's faced intense scrutiny in the media, and as has Judge Brett Kavanaugh. Dr. Ford has received death threats. She's been discredited by lawmakers and President Trump. And Judge Kavanaugh said the allegations have destroyed his family and his good name. So what is the responsibility of the media in covering allegations such as these?
You're talking about one of the most powerful positions within our democracy. A Supreme Court justice is tremendously powerful. As everyone knows, it's a lifetime appointment. I think that as a check on government, news media do have a responsibility to inform the public about matters that may affect their estimation of whether a person is fit for office. I personally have been a little concerned about some of the framing in the current case, moving this toward, almost a criminal case approach, you know, covering it as something that, you know, would only be appropriate to report on it if charges had been brought. And that's just to me, not where we have been in the past with Supreme Court appointments. For instance, in the 1980s, you had Douglas Ginsburg, a nominee, withdraw his nomination after some reports of marijuana smoking. And, you know, we weren't framing it at that time that, well, he would only withdraw if we could be bringing drug charges against him. You know, it's just this very, it's a different frame to say whether we are, you know, accusing someone of a crime and there's proof beyond a reasonable doubt versus we're trying to look into this person's record and character and decide whether they're fit for this incredibly powerful office. So it's been an interesting framing, both in the Senate hearing as well as in some news media coverage.
You think the media is driving that then?
No, I don't think that it is primarily news media that are deciding on that framing. It seems that there are, you know, different people on, you know, with who are advocating for different aspects of this, and they're trying to get their frame to dominate. And news media respond to that and have to kind of suss out how they're going to frame the story themselves.
Well, do you think that the media is being responsible in how they're covering this story or just allegations that have come out in the last few years with sexual assault?
Yeah, so I'm going to edit your question and encourage you not to use the term the media, because I think it's really important for people to realize that we're in an age where there are things that look like they're supposed to be neutral news coverage, but they don't act like neutral news coverage. And I mentioned that this just feels different to me than what we experienced, back in the 80s with Douglas Ginsburg as a Reagan appointee. And even if you go to the Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill controversy, we do have, with digital media, a proliferation of partisan sources, and they certainly are affecting how this discussion and debate are being framed. I don't think that news organizations that strive to be neutral, I don't think any of us ever really can be completely objective, but those that strive to be neutral in their coverage, I think, are trying to figure out what is the way to frame this, how best to report this for the public, and they're being careful. I do think that the Washington Post was responsible in the time they took to, you know, investigate this, to not name someone who had requested confidentiality with both her name and the information that she was sharing. So I've seen a lot of responsible steps being taken. I will say in the last 48 hours, as some of these newer allegations have emerged, there seems to be information moving too quickly and driven too much by competition. So things that are coming out before we're really having a chance to look at and vet who is making that accusation. And those are always difficult things in journalism. Speed and competition really are countervailing pressures to ethics. They're the things that can help us make the wrong choices sometimes.
Well, and I appreciate you correcting me on that, because, I mean, there is a tendency right now to group all of the media together as one single entity that
right.
can tend to be portrayed as evil or
right.
perpetrating fake news. So I appreciate that. I guess I'm wanting to just kind of draw attention to how things are being reported right now and those pressures that you mentioned. You know, is ratings one that you feel might be impacting how this is being covered?
Oh, sure. Right. You know, ratings are a representation of competition. And I would say not just ratings. I would say, you know, clicks on a website, shares of a social media stream. You know, everyone is trying to get attention. They're trying to have people follow their story. I don't think that, you know, as the Blasey Ford allegations broke, I didn't see those breaking early or breaking in an unjustified way, you know, merely to get clicks or to get viewers. They seem to me to be very carefully and thoughtfully reported. Now, some of these later allegations, you know, I do worry that we're now have a bunch of people who are trying to say, okay, now we're onto the story. We're going to break this first.
So maybe that, as you pointed out before, that the speed is not doing justice to all of the allegations or information that is out there that could lead to the truth.
Yeah, there's an age-old adage in journalism that it's more important to be right than to be first. But when you're chasing one of the biggest stories of the decade, you can lose sight of that very, very important caution. I don't think a lot of people will remember, you know, where they first read about something, but they will remember if they read something that was wrong.
Well, I also feel like there's been attention more recently on how the media could do a better job covering allegations of sexual assault, such as using different language when writing stories. You know, I guess my question for you is just how is the media evolving in its coverage of, you know, as sexual assault awareness and movements have grown in the last several years?
I think the Me Too movement has been incredibly eye-opening for news media in a few different ways, all of them important. I mean, first and foremost, they've had to own up to the kinds of sexual misconduct, abuse, harassment, and assault that are happening within their own organizations. So, you know, some of the most high-profile Me Too cases have involved media figures, and that's been a really interesting situation, a really interesting thorny set of issues for news media to wrestle with. You know, when you are Nora O'Donnell on the CBS Morning Show, and you need to report that Charlie Rose has been fired for sexual misconduct, then that's a really heady situation. I think this new attention to sexual misconduct has prompted news organizations and individual journalists to think about the words that they use, the language that they use, how you can verify stories without the kinds of evidence that you would normally seek when you're reporting the news. You know, there's no, if someone is making an allegation of misconduct, it's not like there's a set of public documents out there that you can check, or if there's some database that's going to help you verify this information. So you are relying on something a person is telling you. But you see with things like the New York Times reporting on Harvey Weinstein, you see attempts to corroborate by going back and asking sources to connect them with people that you might have told about this contemporaneously. So let's go back and see if you were saying anything to your roommate or your partner at the time that this happened, and using that as a way to corroborate these stories. Because, you know, make no mistake about it, with many of these situations, these have been rumored for years. It's not as if journalists had not heard about these over time. But people needed to sort of open their eyes and say, wait a minute, this actually can be reported.
Is it because of the way that there's lack of documents or hard evidence that there is reluctance to report that in the past then?
Sure. I mean, I think that, you know, in journalism, you can't really go with something that you can't prove. So, you know, another popular line is, even if your mother tells you she loves you, go get a second source. and so here, if it's a situation where only two people know what has happened, you know, how do you verify that situation? There were only two people in that hotel room, Harvey Weinstein and one of his victims. How do you verify what happened there and then report on it?
Well, this hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee has been streamed live online and broadcast live on television and radio. How is coverage of what we're seeing right now with these sexual assault allegations different from what we've seen with past coverage?
There's simply more coverage now. You know, if you set this against the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas hearings, we were at a point where the internet was not, you know, walking around with all of us in our pockets on our smartphone. And so I think you're seeing a trend toward more watching through different channels, so being able to, you know, stream C-SPAN while you're at work on your laptop, but then also more participation, so more people challenging the narrative, asking questions via social media tools like Twitter or Facebook, you know, offering up their opinions, offering up their response. And if you look at that, you really can see how very, very divided we are. You know, people really are divided on what's happening here. And whatever the outcome is, plenty of people are going to be unhappy about it.
Well, what can we expect from coverage in the days to come?
In the days to come, it's going to depend on what happens. I am concerned. One of my ethics concerns when it comes to news media coverage of anything that happens in Washington, D.C., is that it's more of a winners-losers kind of game frame. And I just think that we should expect more. We should ask more of our news media coverage. So if the nomination were to fail, let's not just frame this as a win for the Democrats or a loss for the Republicans, but let's do some deeper analysis about what it means to have a Supreme Court nomination, what it means to be fit for that position. Are we really judging character, or are we, you know, purely looking at matters of legal writing and legal belief?
Well, is there anything I'm missing that you would like to add?
One thing that I would add that is very challenging for news media is this thing that's called the hostile media effect. It's this very well-researched phenomenon with consumption of media coverage, that when you have people who have a partisan position, so they're on the left or they're on the right, you can show them the exact same text or video, something that's built to be neutral, and they will both interpret it as hostile to their position. So you can imagine that when you have partisans reading, the front page story on today's hearings in the Washington Post, on the left or the right, people are going to be unhappy and they're going to see it as hostile to their view of what has happened. So if they are strongly in favor of Brett Kavanaugh, they're going to see it as biased against him. If they truly believe Dr. Blasey Ford, they're going to see it biased against her. And that's a very, very difficult position for news media to be in. When consumers are bringing their own biases to bear when they encounter these messages, you could be God Almighty writing the most perfectly neutral story, and it still would be problematic for some of the people who are consuming it. And so we often talk about ethics as being only, you know, for journalists. But actually, you know, we have a responsibility as citizens to challenge our own worldview, to say that not everything should be viewed through the whatever ideological lens we happen to have on. That, you know, there are things that we need to do as critical thinkers to engage with content and say, well, what how might I look at this differently?
Again, you were just listening to Kathleen Bartson-Culver. She's the James E. Burgess Chair of Journalism Ethics at UW-Madison. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but when we come back, we'll hear from Martina Tendrup with the Center Against Sexual and Domestic Abuse in Superior. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us on this last Friday in September. Last year, law enforcement in Superior and Douglas County received 481 calls related to domestic violence. The Center Against Sexual and Domestic Abuse in Superior received more than 1,900 calls for help. Up next, we hear from the center's Martina Tendrup. She is the Domestic Abuse Program Coordinator with CASDA. She spoke with me recently about domestic violence in the community and why people may be hesitant to report it. You know, there's been a lot of attention, at least this week and really in the last couple of years, surrounding sexual assault. This week, there were the allegations that are being addressed by Christine Blasey Ford against Judge Brett Kavanaugh. And there's been a lot of criticism of Dr. Ford because the allegations stem from an incident more than three decades ago. We're talking about domestic violence, but I think there are similarities in that survivors of abuse are hesitant to come forward and may suffer in silence. So I guess I'm just wondering, what are some of the reasons people do not report incidents of domestic abuse?
Well, there is very, very similar to sexual assault. People don't report incidents of domestic abuse often because they feel like they're not going to be believed. The domestic abuse encompasses a pattern of often encompasses a pattern of coercive control that will keep a survivor in silence because they may have an abuser that tells them, if you report, I'm going to harm you in some way. I'm going to harm your children in some way. I'm going to get back at you somehow. We also know that sometimes the justice system doesn't always work out the way that survivors would hope, and it's not for sure that they will be able to protect them. You know, a restraining order does hold abusers accountable, but ultimately they often feel like it's still just a piece of paper. So it really doesn't stop somebody from attacking them or threatening them in some way, shape, or form. So those are a lot of the same similar reasons, in that they're just not sure that they can actually be safe if they report to law enforcement.
That they'll be protected.
Well, they don't especially. I mean, the justice system tries to hold offenders accountable, but victims don't always feel that they're being held accountable. I mean, you have to remember that they're potentially suffering in years of somebody telling them that these are the things you can do, these are the things that you can't do, and the abuser is telling them that I have complete and utter control over you and what's going to happen to you. And it's very difficult for a survivor to feel like they have control over their own lives. And, I mean, if they're believing the abuser that he's going to come back at her, I mean, she'll suffer, because most domestic violence is committed against females, but we do also need to recognize that it is men and women who can be victims of domestic violence. But if you have an abuser that's telling them for many years that they're not safe, a victim isn't especially going to believe that the justice system can keep them safe.
Especially if they've been unsafe in those situations with the abuser.
Exactly. I mean, they've been in unsafe situations, and they are the ones who really know what the abuser is capable of. So if the abuser is telling them, I'm going to kill you, or I'm going to hurt you if you call law enforcement, or I'm going to hurt your children, I mean, it's really a matter of what is the best way to keep themselves safe, and the victim is the one that really knows how best to keep themselves safe.
Well, I guess that kind of goes into my next question, because, you know, I was looking at the numbers that you have for Superior and Douglas County, and it says that basically in the last few years that law enforcement over that time are responding to fewer calls. I believe in 2015 and 2016 they responded to around 600 calls, but last year that fell to under 500.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, calls to your organization went up during that time. So I guess my question is, are people reaching out more for help but not to authorities?
You know, I guess I would not be able to expressly say that that's exactly what's happening. That's certainly possible and could definitely be one of the reasons. I know when we have victims that come here and they haven't reported, we will talk to them about what they can do to safety planning. And we do encourage them to report, but also leaving it in the ball in their court, you know, like they need to be the ones who are making that decision for themselves, and we support them in whatever decision it is that they make. But I mean, it's certainly possible that people are reaching out for it, but not especially to law enforcement or going public with it, because they are afraid of some of these things that happen as a result. I mean, we see it with Dr. Blasey Ford. That I mean, she's in many ways, I would imagine, feels like she's probably on trial for coming forward with this, which she shouldn't be.
Well, and that's something that senators on the committee have reiterated over and over, that she's not on trial, although they have special victims prosecutor, I believe, who's asking her questions.
Mm-hmm.
Despite what's happening right now in current events, do you feel like there's more awareness or understanding for victims of sexual assault or domestic violence?
I think we're getting there. I think there is an increased awareness of it. With that awareness comes some backlash. That's not to say that people shouldn't come forward and shouldn't report and make this known, because I really think the only way we're going to build awareness and continue having these conversations is by talking about it and talking to people who have actually experienced it. But with that comes other people that say, well, you're lying, I don't believe you, you're trying to cause problems for somebody else. I know the abuser at work, and they work really hard, and they're a good person, they're nice to everybody else, that kind of thing. So I just can't see how that person could be an abuser. When the fact of the matter is that this type of abuse often happens behind closed doors. It's not something that you're going to see out in the public. Less than a quarter of abusers have what one might consider like anger issues that can be seen in the public eye, somebody who is attacking a victim in the public, which means that 75% of them are doing all of this behind closed doors, and nobody else would ever guess that the abuse is happening. Your original question had been, you know, is there more awareness about it? Yes, I believe that there is more awareness, and we're having more conversations about it. But sometimes that can be mitigated by the backlash that people don't especially believe that these things are happening. And that has been, that is definitely a problem, and something that will keep other victims silenced, because they don't especially want to be in the public eye or have somebody tell them that this trauma that happened to them didn't happen.
Well, and it's so tough to face public scrutiny with something that's very personal. And I guess, you know, one of the things that you touched on that I wanted to go back to is just when allegations have come out against people and others have known them, and they have expressed disbelief at times, as you pointed out, like, I can't believe that they would do that. I know them. You know, this is something that's not in their character. But could possibly part of the reason for that stem from the fact that where we are culturally, or where we have been culturally, where things in the past were just considered normal as part of relationships between men and women, or, you know, same-sex relationships for that matter, part of the things that we felt were normal in the past are now being pointed out, no, that's not right. That's not what should be done. And that men and women are still coming to a realization surrounding that?
Oh, absolutely. That's the history of domestic violence, of changing relationships and coming to an awareness about what domestic violence is, has been going on for at least 100 years, longer than that. But, you know, I'll go back specifically to like the suffrage movement, when women were trying to get the vote. That same point in time, a lot of the suffragettes were also in support of the temperance movement, because they wanted their husbands not to be allowed to drink and then go home and beat on them. So there was this association that alcohol was causing the violence. We know now that alcohol can exacerbate the violence, but it really doesn't cause the violence. But that development has been happening, that change and critical thinking about what relationships are and how relationships develop has been happening for a very long time. And we're still in the middle of it. We're still trying to figure out what exactly a healthy relationship is and change the social norms so that people recognize and understand that violence is not okay in any way, shape, or form, regardless. And I think that also stems to the broader society and just kind of sometimes our acceptance of violence in many forms, violence towards other people that maybe aren't intimate partners. I mean, we have just sort of this very deeply ingrained philosophy in our culture that in some situations violence is okay, and we really need to get away from that because those are some of the things that are helping reinforce and reiterate those violent relationships.
So you were talking about how part of our culture seems to normalize certain aspects of violence, and I mean, I think socially, culturally, it might be difficult for people to speak up and say, when they witness something, that no, that's not right, this is wrong, and take action based on that because of fears of violence turning on them.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I, for somebody that feels like they're in a safe, I'm not going to tell somebody that they shouldn't step in a violent situation, but I'm also not going to tell somebody that they should step in on a violent situation simply because ultimately it comes down to my safety first. So if I see something going on, I'm not especially going to jump in and break it up, but I would certainly encourage if you witness violence to call the police and, you know, trained professionals who are there to handle that kind of thing. But I think even there's a sense that in some situations that violence is okay. And I guess I don't especially believe that's true. I advocate for nonviolence in all situations.
So do you feel like movements like Me Too or Time's Up are encouraging men and women to speak up about violence in your mind, or do you
Absolutely.
Think it might be having the opposite effect?
I think overall, I think there overall there's so much support behind it, and people having the recognizing that there are other people out there. A lot of the pervasiveness of sexual and domestic violence has to do with the fact that it does happen in silence, and it does happen behind closed doors, and you often feel isolated. And like you're the only one who's suffering this, and don't really know how to move forward with it. When we have movements like Me Too and Time's Up, we're building that conversation. Now, again, I feel that there can sometimes be some backlash, and there may be some people who just say, "Nope, this isn't for me." But I think overall, recognizing that there are people out there who have the same experiences or who have similar experiences to what yours were, is going to allow people to open up and speak about what has happened to them and the effects that it's had on them in their lives.
Well, and I guess specifically here for Superior and Douglas County, do you feel like we're making progress on preventing violence against men or women?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a very slow-moving process. I will give you that. But CASDA, it has a very good relationship with interested parties such as law enforcement and the district attorneys, and we are moving forward and holding offenders more accountable than they were 30 years ago prior to CASDA's existence. So, I absolutely think that we are doing a much better job now as a city and county than we were in years past. But I think that's probably the same for many places also.
There's been grant funding that was awarded too, right? So that a CASDA specialist could work with law enforcement on crimes as well, or no?
Yes. We actually, Superior Police Department was awarded a grant, I think it was a year ago, where there is actually an advocate that is embedded at the police department that pulls reports and does kind of a history of the offender and forwards that to the district attorney so that they can make recommendations about bail based on what this person's history is, whereas that wasn't I mean, the district attorneys would do some of that themselves before, but when we have an advocate and an advocate's perspective, and they're able to do some of that work for the district attorneys. Obviously, they are very busy and don't always have time to pull a full record, whereas the advocate can. That is specifically what they're there to do.
Well, next month is Domestic Violence Awareness Month.
Mm-hmm.
And you have some events that are being held, and the kickoff is next Tuesday, October 2nd. So what are some of those events that are going to be taking place?
So on Tuesday, October 2nd, we will have a proclamation by the mayor of Superior, Mayor Jim Payne, proclaiming October as Domestic Violence Awareness Month in the city of Superior. The courthouse will be lit for the first week of October, will be lit in purple in recognition of Domestic Violence Awareness Month. The proclamation happens at 10 a.m. at the Government Center atrium, and anyone is invited. Mayor Jim Payne will be speaking, Councillor Vance Sickle, I will speak a little bit, and we also will have a survivor's story as well, which I think will be really important. After that, we will be planting flags on the courthouse lawn in recognition of domestic violence. The Spirit Room has agreed to create a purple drink that they will have sort of featured throughout the month of October. Purple is the color of Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Wednesday Bakery will have purple treats for us on October 17th, again in recognition of Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And on October 25th, we will have a forum that is free and open to the public from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. at VIP Pizza. There will be free food, and we will do an interactive exercise trying to highlight some of the reasons that victims stay in abusive relationships. We are also hoping to have a survivor's story there and kind of a discussion about what are the best ways to approach victims, and, of course, any questions that anybody has about domestic violence.
Well, that should be pretty eye-opening for people who don't see the impacts of that every day.
Yes, I've done that interactive experience a number of times, and it's always very eye-opening for people and recognizing sort of the situations that somebody might be in for the reasons they might stay.
Well, before I let you go, I guess if you could name one thing, what would you say would be the most important thing to prevent domestic violence in our community moving forward? What would you like to see?
I would like to reiterate that we really need to believe survivors and recognize that they are in a situation where they feel very out of control of their lives and feel like they have lost their autonomy for who they are, and the best thing that we can do for them, regardless of what decisions they make, is support them. So if their decision is to not go to law enforcement, we need to support that in the best way that we can. If their decision is to return to the abuser because they feel that that's what's safest for them and their family, then we need to support them in that and really recognize that the power needs to get back into the victim's hands and that where it isn't at this point in time.
Well, I really appreciate you taking time to speak with me, Martina. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Again, you've been listening to Martina Tendrup, Domestic Abuse Program Coordinator with the Center Against Sexual and Domestic Abuse in Superior. We're going to take a short break for these announcements. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin recently passed an emergency rule that aims to slow the spread of chronic wasting disease. But Republican State Senator Steve Noss asked the Senate's Rules Committee to hold a hearing on Monday to consider suspending or blocking all parts of that rule. It would place new restrictions on deer farms that would require them to add a second fence or another barrier. And it would prevent hunters from moving harvested deer from CWD-affected areas. This week, the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission sent a letter to Senator Noss and committee members asking them to support new restrictions to protect the wild deer herd. The commission represents 11 tribes in Minnesota, Michigan, and Wisconsin. Up next, we hear from Jonathan Gilbert. He's the director of biological services with the commission.
The tribes are really concerned about chronic wasting disease. It can have negative impacts on deer and their population levels. And there's research, current research, that shows that there's a potential for this prion disease to cross species boundaries to affect humans. You know, they've done some testing with primates and such, and they see that it actually can do that. So for two reasons, I mean, the tribe's treaty rights gives them the right to hunt deer to meet their cultural needs. And if deer populations go away or are greatly reduced because of a disease, that's a concern because now tribes can't actually harvest enough to meet their needs. And if the deer that are present here are sick in a way that can make people sick, well, then certainly the tribes don't want to harvest those deer to feed to their families and communities, risking the transmission of a disease. And so the big picture is the tribes are really concerned about the spread of chronic wasting disease into the ceded territories. It will fundamentally undermine their treaty rights. So the question is, what can be done about that? Well, there are certain risk factors that are out there for the spread of chronic wasting disease. And the letter that you're talking about addresses a couple of those risk factors. That is the spread of the disease inadvertently by people who are transporting diseased carcasses around, killing a deer in an area where there's CWD, and moving the carcass, which we know has CWD in it, moving it to a place that doesn't have CWD, that remains an infectious agent, poses a risk to the deer in that new area. That's one way that this disease can spread. Certainly, we should minimize that risk by saying if people shoot a deer in an area where we know we have CWD, well, don't take the part of the carcass out that can spread that disease. Seems fairly reasonable. The second risk factor that's addressed here is this fencing idea. Well, we are quite sure that game farms and deer farms especially are one method by which CWD is being spread around the country. And if we can, you know, we've been really adamant to the state that, you know, deer farms are not a good way to go. They should not be allowed. You know, they are risky for diseases, CWD and others. But that's fallen on deaf ears for the most part. And so, well, if we're going to have these things, at least we should keep them isolated from the wild deer as best we can. And that's what the double fencing requirement would do. Would attempt to keep those farms isolated so that any deer from the farm does not interact with any wild deer and thus risk spreading this disease to the wild deer.
Well, what do you say then to Senator Noss, who has come out, you know, and scheduled this hearing, and he said that these rules that are going to take effect are happening with little advance notice to hunters before, you know, the November hunting season?
So then it's a matter of not whether or not the rules are good, but about the timing of them, right? I'm not sure that that's what he's advocating, that it's good rules that we just need a little more public education about. What I understand, he's saying that this is an undue burden on the hunters in the state and placing people at risk for citations when they didn't know better. It was more that than these are good ideas and we just need to inform our hunters better so they can conform to the rules.
Well, I think that he's kind of saying that, yeah, that goes hand in hand. I mean, if they don't have enough notice, then they're probably likely to get ticketed because they haven't been paying attention to the rule taking effect. And that maybe this should just be delayed for a while, or I think they're looking to suspend it on Monday.
So there's been other rules that have come up in response to CWD. For example, when a county is listed as a CWD county, baiting and feeding of deer is no longer allowed in that county, right? That's an existing rule on the books. Well, I think when that rule first came out, and perhaps even now still, but certainly when it first came out, enforcement people used that as an opportunity to educate hunters or those that might be using bait or feed. And so somebody was feeding inappropriately or baiting inappropriately. If the warden found them, they used that opportunity as an educational time. They could inform them about the risks and the reason for that. Maybe not bring them to court and fine them the first year or second year. You know, use that as an opportunity to teach people about this. And eventually people get used to it. And then, you know, when violations occur, then you begin to cite them. And I would suspect that there would be similar kinds of efforts with this rule as well, that if a warden found somebody transporting a deer out of a CWD area, they would take that opportunity to educate that person and tell them about the reasons for that, hopefully after some period of time. And I agree, you know, people need to know what's going on. It's really hard to keep track of all these things sometimes. I agree with that. But we could still put it on the books and then use that regulation as a time to educate people rather than throwing them to court.
Again, you were listening to Jonathan Gilbert with the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. Deer farmers in Wisconsin oppose the emergency rule. Rick Wojtek is the president of Whitetails of Wisconsin. He had this to say about it last month before the state's Natural Resources Board.
Science was there that it would stop a deer farm from getting CWD. I am sure 99% of deer farmers would put up the double fence without any need of any law. The farmers in this room and most of those that are members of Whitetails of Wisconsin are not deer farming as a hobby. They're small businesses. As a small business, you need to make responsible decisions in running your business. We have not seen where a double fence has slowed down the spread of CWD. There's still a lot not known about how CWD is spreading, but if you look at most farms that have tested positive for CWD, we are not seeing a correlation with transportation of live deer or with CWD being spread to the animals through the fence. There are a lot of ways that prions are being spread through the environment, and when looking at the science available, spending the money to put up a second fence gives additional cost with what seems to be very little gain in protection against CWD.
The Senate's Rules Committee will hold a hearing on the emergency rule Monday morning at 10 a.m. at the state capitol in Madison. And now it's time for a look back on some of the news of the week. The U.S. Chemical Safety Board says it will hold a public hearing this fall in Duluth about the agency's investigation into the Husky Oil Refinery in Superior. The announcement comes in response to a request by five congressional lawmakers to seek more public input about the investigation and the refinery's use of hydrogen fluoride, a highly toxic chemical. An explosion at the refinery in April led to an evacuation. Details about a date and location for the meeting are yet to be determined. A recent report on the Husky refinery explosion found social media caused confusion for emergency crews trying to evacuate people from Superior this past April, and that is prompting changes on how information is shared in an emergency. When an explosion at the Husky oil refinery punctured an asphalt tank and sparked fires in April, Julia Johnson was working at home about 3 miles away.
That one doesn't really latch. This one doesn't really either. It's an old. This is an addition.
Johnson works at a Duluth nonprofit that gives people information in a disaster or an emergency. But it was Johnson who needed information about what was going on after black smoke began filling the sky over the refinery. People were being told to evacuate, but Johnson says checking Facebook and news websites, it wasn't clear what areas were in the evacuation zone.
I checked one page and it said within 1 mile of the explosion, One said 1 to 3, and then both of them said 3 to 5.
News reports weren't helping straighten it out.
If you're 10 miles south and within 2 or 3 miles to the northeast and west of the Husky Oil Refinery.
Anyone within 5 miles of that facility is now being asked to evacuate.
3 miles on either side, on all sides to the north, east, and west of the refinery, and then 10 miles to the south.
Residents from 3 miles around have been told to evacuate.
Douglas County Emergency Management Director Keith Kessler says there was a lot of confusion about the evacuation area that day. A report on the emergency response points to social media.
Information that was not 100% accurate got out that perhaps caused the evacuation zone to be a little larger than it was originally intended to be. Working with social media can be very difficult. It's hard to control.
A lot of agencies and people were giving out different evacuation orders on Twitter and Facebook, like the National Weather Service and the Superior Police Department. Even Superior Mayor Jim Payne shared evacuation information that wasn't quite right. But he says social media and confusion go hand in hand.
I'm just not feeling terribly apologetic for either myself or anybody else that issued an order for doing so. Once they saw danger, they told people to get out of danger and they gave them the best information they could at the time that they had it.
If the same thing happened today, Payne says they would respond better. He and other agencies have gone through training so that everyone knows their roles in an emergency. Douglas County's Kessler says many had already been through that training, but they're improving how they work together. That includes designating a single point person to share information.
We're going to work more to try to develop a better public information program to try to get everyone saying the same thing at a similar time.
Kessler says there's always a few wild cards, but he feels the emergency response went pretty much by the book. But that's no comfort to Johnson, who returned home that night thinking the fire was out and the evacuation order had been lifted.
They had put it out like a little bit, but it had restarted. So the evacuation was still on until like 9 a.m. the next day.
Superior Police tweeted the evacuation would last about 2 more hours after the fire was put out that night, but later corrected that post. Johnson says they were trusting emergency crews and city leaders to give them the best information to keep them safe.
I would prefer if they don't know. They say they don't know, and they say it's indefinite because they're putting people's lives at risk, putting out wrong information.
And the actual evacuation area that day? The county's report said it was a 1 mile radius around the refinery, 10 miles south, and 3 miles east and west of the southern evacuation line. The Natural Resources Board unanimously approved closing Wisconsin's rough grouse season early to protect the birds' declining numbers. But critics say there's no scientific reason for the change. Rough grouse are known for drumming. They beat their wings slowly and then more rapidly as part of spring mating rituals. It sounds like this. DNR staff heard less of that this year. Their counts were down more than a third from last year. The number of birds harvested is at its lowest level in decades. The cause isn't clear, but some fear West Nile virus could be to blame. Ken Jonas is with a group of former DNR scientists known as Wisconsin's Green Fire. He says there's no science to back up the agency's move.
There's no certainty that an early hunting season closure will measurably impact statewide rough grouse breeding population indices for 2019.
Natural Resources Board member Greg Kazmierski agrees science is lacking to manage the state's ruffed grouse population.
That's a total dropping of the ball from our scientific community that then turned around, circled the wagons, and are accusing the board of knee-jerk reactions and moving without science. Well, there's a reason why we move without science, because there isn't any.
The season will end for most areas of the state on New Year's Eve. A DNR official says they plan to present a conservation management plan for ruffed grouse to the board by 2020. The board also approved changes for rules guiding when the state holds elk hunts. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources has been deciding when to hold a hunt based on the number of elk up until now. The state set a threshold to allow hunts in Clam Lake once the herd there reached around 200 animals. In Jackson County, that number was set at about 150 elk. Current rules allow the agency to issue hunting permits for 5% of the population. Under the change, the DNR Scott Carroll says they'll analyze whether the herd could handle a hunt.
We would also be moving away from a formula to determine the number of tags issued and instead make it based on scientific data, which would give us a lot more flexibility to for what number of tags are issued or appropriate for this herd.
The agency will consider a number of factors on whether to hold a hunt, including the age, sex, and location of the animals. Lawmakers in Congress have advanced a proposal to strip protections from gray wolves across the contiguous U.S. amid a push by Republicans for broad changes to the Endangered Species Act. The U.S. House Natural Resources Committee approved the measure from Republican Congressman Sean Duffy on Wednesday, sending it to the full House. It's a signal of growing frustration among Republicans over court actions restoring protections for the species that government scientists declared to be recovered. The latest case is a ruling this week restoring protections for grizzly bears in and around Yellowstone National Park, blocking public hunts of the bears in Wyoming and Idaho. Federal officials removed protections for wolves in the Great Lakes region in 2011 before a court restored protections in 2014. Wolves are not federally protected in the Northern Rockies. A newly released analysis says a federal Great Lakes cleanup program is good for the region's economy. The study says every dollar spent on the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative during its first 7 years will generate an additional $3.35 billion of economic activity through the year 2036. It was based on research at the University of Michigan and case studies from a number of cities in the eight-state region. The initiative was established under President Barack Obama in 2010. It has provided more than $2.5 billion for thousands of projects that clean up toxic pollution, fight invasive species, prevent runoff, and restore wildlife habitat. According to the report, the program has created or supported thousands of jobs. It has particularly strengthened tourism and boosted housing values in Great Lakes coastal communities. And that's a look back on some of the news of the week, and that's it for our program. You can hear it again online on our website at wpr.org/superior. You can also find us on iTunes under Hear Me Out. I'm Danielle Kading, and you've been listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. We hope to have you back with us again next week. Until then, have a great weekend.